नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स अपारुथादे संगमतस्स थवराये सुरवन्था बमुञ्चन्तु सदा So this afternoon, the subject for reflection is gratitude to parents. And this has become an annual event, I think a very important one. Because to develop gratitude, this takes reflection. And by reflection and contemplation, these are using the mind to remember or to bring up into consciousness certain subjects that apply to not just not theory, but to our life, to ourselves, to our experience here and now. And in developing Buddhist meditation means that there's the mindfulness practice to be aware, develop this awareness of the present, to keep your attention into the present rather than thinking about things, letting the mind wander to the past or to the future. To concentrate on the way it is now in terms of the breath or the posture, the state of mind. But also, in our practice, developing states of mind quite intentionally that bring happiness and joy into consciousness. So there's the reflections on metta practice, metta bhavana, which is a kind of necessary basis for reflection, because this is our ability to bring up this subject of loving kindness, try to develop the feeling for it, not just some abstract idea of it, but a sense of accepting, forgiving, not dwelling on the faults, flaws, inadequacies, wrongs of oneself or anyone else. So critical mind, as it's highly developed now through modern education, tends to be very much aware of the things that are wrong, the faults either of oneself, we can be very self-critical, or towards our parents, we can obsess our minds with the mistakes or the things that they haven't done right or they've done wrong, or sins of omission or commission, whatever. With teachers, with authority figures, grandparents, doctors, lawyers, prime ministers, and everyone else. Friends, goes on endlessly, because in this human realm we can imagine a kind of perfect parent or perfect prime minister, or what a teacher should be, or a perfect husband or a perfect wife, or a perfect mother, perfect father. So we think of how things should be according to the ideals that we have, and because we can create these ideals, then we can also feel very angry or enraged or resentful for the fact that so much of our experience, the people that we've been involved to, haven't been perfect. And so we become very obsessed with this sense of blaming. We develop what we call a victim mentality, which means, you know, that it's your fault that I suffer, that if you'd done all the right things, I wouldn't suffer like this. If life had treated me fairly and justly and all the rest, then I wouldn't have any problems now. But because I have so much suffering and anguish and stress, it's your fault. And of course, the worldly mind, that's my, you know, for many cases, one can even agree with that to a certain degree. I mean, some people have had, you know, seem to be born into, you know, situations where they're not loved or appreciated, where life has been pretty dreadful to them. And yet this problem arises even with those of us who've been born in quite fortunate situations, you know, where we can still find plenty of things that our parents should have done that they didn't do, or they shouldn't have done some of the things they did. And then we can feel quite put out by this. And the sense of blaming and dwelling on what's wrong goes inward to ourselves, because then we see ourselves through oftentimes the habits of negativity, what's wrong with us, what our inadequacy is, our weakness, our fault. And it's a time where psychology is very dominant in the consciousness of the Western world, where we're fed a diet of kind of psychology terms and jargon, therapeutic practices, and all kinds of ways of trying to understand what life is all about. Why are we the way that we are? Why can't we be perfect? Why can't we find permanent happiness and love and security and be a loving, joyful human being, as the ideal is? Instead, we create a lot of stress in our minds, a lot of feelings of despair, depression. So the type of meditation, say, developing metta practice, then is it's not an ignoring the faults or denying anything. So it's not developing good thinking by suppressing the negative thought. It's not meant to look away or to try to create an illusory world of happiness and love. But its function is to recognize that the development of positive mental states has its own reward. Like when people ask about the law of karma, this is a common question that I'm asked very often about what is the law of karma. And of course, there's a coarse view of this, such as in a previous life, I must have done something to be this person in this life, and my actions and in this life will determine what I will be reborn as in the next life. So that's generally referred to as reincarnation. And then, but when we talk about the law of karma, we're talking about cause and effect. And of course, this is simply put, when you do a good deed or have a good thought, you have a good result. If you do something bad, then you have a bad result. So it's like if you plant a mango seed, you get a mango tree rather than a fir tree. Whatever you plant, then you get that fruit as a result of it. So putting this in the perspective of here and now, then, and it just knows, like in monastic life, we have all these reflections that we do. Monastic, they're called samana sanya, or reflections for samanas or monastics. And these are part of a daily reflection, really. And so the reflection on karma is part of our daily practice. If you think a good thought, the result is good. I mean, in the here and now. Now, if you just test this out, when you think a loving thought, then at that very moment, as you kind of fully give yourself to thinking in a good way or a positive way, the result is that you feel quite good. At least I found this works with me. If I'm fighting against, if I'm filled with negativity at the time, I'm angry, and I'm trying to think good thoughts, then it doesn't seem to work, because then I'm trying to suppress. If I'm just using positive thinking to suppress negative thinking, then it doesn't work very well. But if you develop, say, metta practice, not in order to suppress negative thought, but to develop an attitude which allows negative thought to be what it is. So if one, say, if you start with you're feeling very negative, suspicious, grumpy, resentful right now, and you try to spread loving kindness to all beings, and all you get back is a cynical reaction. They say, you know, you're feeling really negative and enraged at the behavior of mankind, and then I say, spread loving kindness to all sentient beings, and then the cynical reaction will be, yeah, rubbish. this is where the mindfulness is necessary, to see what state of mind you're in the present. You know, you can't just transform yourself magically, but you're working with the way it is. So just by noting, you can just be aware, right now I'm feeling very resentful, very angry, very upset, and I hate all sentient beings at this moment. And be aware of that in an accepting way, in the attitude of metta, then it isn't judging, it's not saying you're bad for feeling this way when you should be full of loving kindness. But it is an acceptance of the way you're feeling right now, which isn't approving or disapproving, it's just receiving, allowing it to be. So this is taking metta practice to a very practical level. It's not just trying to think good thoughts by suppressing negative ones, but when the negative ones arise, to recognize them, receive them in this way of metta. Metta is when we translate that into the English words loving kindness. Of course, people have different ways of even defining loving kindness. The word love itself is a very difficult word, because it's used for almost everything. And so this is where we need to define how we're going to use these words, so that we become clear in our own mind when we're thinking and using thought, that we know what we're doing. We're not just getting lost in the confusion of our thoughts, but we can actually determine what we mean. So for me, the word love means unconditional love. There's no deals made with it. It's allowing things to be what they are, even if I don't like them personally, or they're evil or bad. It's not saying I love evil, but it's this unconditioned ability to not hate, not create anger and hatred around it. not to, and to allow even an evil thought to be what it is, means that its power is, you're disempowering that thought. You know, evil gets power through our resistance to it. If you've noticed in your own mind, the more you resist and fight against negative thoughts, they seem to get more and more powerful. The more you try to deny, suppress those thoughts, then they seem to pursue you like the Furies in Greek legends. So, in this way, love doesn't mean like. It doesn't mean I like evil. It doesn't mean I approve, or I'm just going to passively allow evil forces to take over. It means that at this moment, then the metta is allowing the evil feeling or thought into consciousness, receiving it, but not resenting it, hating it, or believing it. So you're looking at it in terms of strictly what it is, condition that arises in the present, and you'll see that its power has been removed. If you accept something for what it is, then you're learning to let it be. It means you're not attaching, you're not getting caught in its delusion, you're not fighting against it in which its power increases, but you're understanding it, you're receiving it in terms of metta. So that's the metta practice. So as I said, it's easy to spread metta when you're feeling good and everything is going well. And it's very inspiring just to spread loving kindness throughout the whole universe. And it's easier to spread loving kindness to all the billion people in China. Sometimes easier to spread loving kindness to a billion Chinese that aren't here. And then the one, the monk sitting next to you who you can't stand. That's the real challenge. I've contemplated this for years, you know, living in monastery, living with monks for so many years, you know, you're living with basically very good people all the time, but yet, personally, you know, sometimes you can't stand some of them. So, and that's a personal thing, isn't it? That's more of a personality thing than you know, if they're not, you know, usually they're, you know, the kind of people that are attracted to monastic life are usually pretty high quality, you know, quite, you know, they're trying their best. And gratitude is reflecting on the that which has been given to us and the good fortune of our life. I developed a lot of gratitude just living as a Buddhist monk, because you're always on you receive so much kindness and generosity from others. And then this stimulates that you begin to remember the good things of your own life. Like my own parents, for example, they were not particularly delighted that I became a Buddhist monk, because they're very devout Catholics, and they wouldn't mind if I became a Catholic monk, but a Buddhist monk is something I think most Westerners, their parents are totally unprepared for, because they could imagine me, you know, as a drug addict or a criminal or a transvestite or whatever. scenario you could imagine at its worst, as well, that I could be President of the United States or Governor of California. But a Buddhist monk, that's a non-plus kind of perception. What is that for most Western parents? And of course, one limitation of Western culture, especially people who have been brought up in strict Jewish or Christian families, usually your perspective on religion is pretty narrow. You know, you're told all the other religions are wrong, basically. And so, I mean, this is, you know, even though my parents knew nothing about any other religions, especially Buddhism, I think the only Buddhist thing they ever saw was one of these little fat Buddhas that was used as an ashtray, you know. So you can imagine they must have wondered about what their son was up to, and if this was their sole, you know, experience with Buddhist iconography. And so they, you know, they didn't know anything about any other religion, but just assumed that they were wrong because they weren't Christian. And actually, we weren't brought up as Roman Catholics. We were brought up in the Anglican Church, very high church, and the Anglo-Catholic Church that I grew up in, they even had doubts about all the Protestants. So, I mean, you know, it was Protestants. I mean, if I'd become a Presbyterian, that would have upset them. So, becoming a Buddhist was totally, you know, way out beyond their ability to comprehend. But being an American also, you have this attitude, once you're 18, you're on your own. You know, you're free from your family, and that was very much my experience. Once I was 18, then I supported myself, I became totally independent, and the idea I can do what I want. So they didn't try to interfere. And eventually, through the efforts of my kind sister, they began to appreciate my life, and when I did return home for the first time in robes, they were very pleased with the result. They said I was much nicer than I used to be. because I had developed this gratitude. I began to think of my mother and father in my life in Thailand, and because you do this a lot in a Buddhist culture, in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Cambodia, countries like this, there's a lot of this kind of reflection. So in this, I've got something quite interesting to read from the Anguttara Nikaya. So the question, those are the statements, monks, two persons, I say it is not easy to repay. Which two? The father and the mother. And then the Buddha goes on, even if monks, one with a lifespan of 100 years, living full 100 years, were to carry one's mother on one shoulder and the father on the other, attending on them by anointing, bathing, and massaging, while they defecate and urinate on his shoulders, even then, one would not have paid or sufficiently repaid one's debt of gratitude to one's parents. And even if, monks, one were to bestow on one's parents the regal splendor of sovereignty over this great earth, with its abundance of seven kinds of gems, even then one would not have paid or sufficiently repaid one's debt of gratitude to one's parents. Why so? Because parents have done so much for their children, they gave them life, nourished them, and showed them this world. But whoever amongst initiates, instills, and inculcates the qualities of faith in parents lacking in faith, morality in parents of poor morals, liberality in parents stingy in giving, and wisdom in parents deficient in wisdom, such a one has paid, sufficiently repaid, and amply repaid the debt of gratitude to his parents. Well, that is a good reflection. Notice that on the worldly level, material level, or on the personal level, but the way of really helping one's parents or repaying the debt is through our own efforts in faith, in morality, in generosity, and in wisdom. So this brings us to begin to see that the wisdom here is in not so much in thinking in the worldly terms, but in the terms of what is really beneficial. How can we repay our debts to people who have been very helpful, kind, or generous, or supportive, or loving to us? So when you think of even 100 years, carrying mother on one shoulder and father on the other, and I mean, they love to carry things to extremes, and but it makes a point, doesn't it? It's a hyperbole, but it does make the point that in our own lives, even if our parents have lacked in various qualities of wisdom or morality or generosity, this is to spend our lives resenting and blaming and hating them for this is a kind of waste of our own life, because we're not improving the situation, we're just increasing our own misery. But in our own effort, say, in developing these qualities of dana or generosity and morality and wisdom, then this is how we can. This is benefiting us as well as our parents, our partners, our friends, relatives, neighbors. If you really want to help the country, the world, a billion Chinese in China, and the monk that you can't stand that sits next to you, then the best way is to develop yourself. Gratitude. Also, I began to just recognize when you've reached my age, then you've seen a lot and heard a lot. And of course, people I meet, they tell me about their lives, and you can see so many people have had very difficult things in life to deal with, and their life, even in countries like this or the United States, where most of the people I know are, quite, they've had fairly good opportunities, and yet so much anguish and despair and misery develops through just the lack of ability, lack of morality in families, or lack of generosity, lack of wisdom. And yet when parents begin their families, these are probably not foremost in their minds, the wisdom faculty. And when you're young, certainly isn't the dominant one for most of us. And generosity in a society that's very much bent on proclaiming our independence, and and thinking of trying to create this vanity, this sense of our self-importance. Think of yourself first attitudes of modern materialistic societies. And morality can even be something that we think is for the past, you know, just the hedonistic attitudes of the past 50 years of just pleasure-seeking and enjoying life help to kind of put a negative taint on the word morality. And yet now we begin to see the result, we're seeing the result of lack of generosity and morality and wisdom is, of course, we live in a very confused time, in a society that doesn't know what it's about, really, and doesn't know where it's going, has no vision, is quite willing to go to war and fight and kill and persecute others in the name of justice or protection or necessity. generosity, you know, when you're living in, especially in welfare states, sometimes the welfare systems, much as I appreciate them, they tend to also create an attitude of see what you can get out of the system, rather than what you can offer for the welfare of your society. And what are my rights and how much can I use the welfare system in Britain so I can get what I want? Or how can I live in this country for the benefit of the society, of British society? I don't hear the other one very much. How can I live for the welfare of this country? Certainly hear a lot of the other. How much can I get out of the system? Having been in the military, in the U.S. Navy for 4 years, one thing that came out of the military with this, this terrible attitude of how much you can get out of the military, how much you can rip off the American government for without getting caught. 4 years of military life. Because this was the general attitude in the Navy at that time. So these are negative states. This does not create a sense of self-worth or joy or happiness in one's life. See how I can use the system for my own ends, or how much I can get for myself. And yet I can fully understand these kind of feelings. I mean, selfishness is certainly, you know, a problem we all have. It's part of our human experience. We have to think of ourselves first, because this is the starting point. This creature sitting right here is the one I have to be with all the time. So in monastic life, then these reflections on gratitude to parents. I started reflecting years ago in Thailand, in the monastery there, just how, you know, the fortunate life I did have with my parents and the opportunities that they made available to me, their own strength. They were very kind of moral people. So they weren't into promiscuity or drugs or anything like that, didn't drink. They were kind, they never, you know, were never abusive. We suffered from the usual problem of nuclear family, the father being away most of the time, and when he comes home he's too tired to talk to you. And that's about, you know, that's one thing I can blame my father for. When I'm in my hate parents mode, and then, but then when I think generally the overall effect of on my life, you know, the security, and you know, they've always provided good food and good living conditions and clothes and all the this that one just takes for granted when you're a child. You know, you don't even think about what your parents have to do to provide all this. You just take it for granted. And of course, as you get older, you know, you begin to recognize that, and as you have your own children or you have your own responsibilities, you begin to see this is not an easy task. You know, you have to spend a lot of time doing things you're not particularly interested in, just to make money to pay the rent or the mortgage or buy the food. Well, this isn't particularly noticeable to most of us when we're young, because we just take it for granted that our parents are there to do this for us, and that's what they're there for. As you grow older, then you understand the difficulties of living, and the sacrifices. I reflect on the sacrifices my parents had to make. I was born right in the middle of the Depression in the 30s. And my parents had lost all their money, so that they were living on the edge. My sister and I were born right in the middle of that. So there was no doubt a lot of anxiety and problems like that that my mother and father must have been feeling, you know, trying to raise two babies with this very unstable economy and just getting by, really. So, but when you're a baby and a child, you don't notice these things. And yet, they did provide stability, and in for me in my childhood and youth. So then, when I think of that, I feel a sense of gratitude, katanyu. The fact that that I was born in a country that had a lot of freedom and. I wasn't bound to all kinds of traditions and things that were oppressive. So there was this sense of, in America in those days, of, you know, freedom, and you could think what you want, and this emphasis on rights, human rights, and liberty, pursuit of happiness. So then, the gratitude to the country you're born in, and to the parents, we were not a family that had close contact with other relatives, so I hardly knew any of my other relatives, but we had neighbors and friends, people like that that were always there, one could count on and appreciate and depend on. So this kind of reflection brings up this gratitude, and then the mind might slip back into its habits of negative thinking. But for this practice, I've determined to just develop the reflection on the good things, the kindness, the generosity, the stability, the graciousness, the opportunities that were available to me. And of course, this is all what leads into a life that led me into monasticism. Because some people might think Buddhist monks were probably, you know, kind of neurotic, inept people that can't face the real world. And no doubt some monks are, I wouldn't. But I wouldn't describe myself as that way. Because the spiritual aspiration, this is one thing I acquired from my mother, especially, a spiritual aspiration. She had a very powerful spiritual life. in her High Church Anglican way. So she was very much, you know, one who prayed and practiced some kind of meditations based on Christian mysticism. So this was, and this she was not a preachy or a woman that would kind of force us into following her, but just the kind of quality she developed, I think, influenced my sister and I very much. So that both my sister and I have had very strong spiritual aspirations. My sister is now she's in her 70s. She's now very much in a third order Carmelite. She's not like a nun. She's married. Her husband lives with her husband, but this lay order. She has a very strong prayer life, meditation life, that's benefiting her in her old age. And of course I moved away from the Christian fold when I discovered Buddhism. So, but my movement into Buddhism has never been half-hearted; it has been total. And where did I acquire this? And my sister and I often contemplated that there's no doubt from this kind of subtle influence from our mother. Who never said very much about it or tried to force this on us, but obviously the power of her awareness, her mind, her prayer life, the goodness and that came from that was definitely had its effect on us as children. Then in monastic life, meeting a teacher like Ajahn Chah. I was very fortunate. I was a monk 1 year, and then the following year I met Ajahn Chah. So it was my second year. And then I was, it seemed like I found by serendipity this excellent, very wise Buddhist monk who received me as one of his disciples. And so this I was extremely grateful for. It seemed like such an, you know, one can see it as coincidence or karma or destiny or however you want to put it, but whatever way you want, whatever words you want to describe that fortunate meeting with him was that it definitely, was something to be grateful for, because now I spent about 10 years with him in Thailand. That was 10 of the most profound years of my life, where you transform from a lay person, a kind of confused American disillusioned man, into someone who really began to break through the superficiality, the delusions of one's mind, through living in a very fortunate situation, and then also just by living with very good and wise teacher like Ajahn Chah. Living with a wise person has its effect. People question, how could he teach you at first? You know what? You couldn't speak Thai, he couldn't speak English. How could he teach you anything? And of course, this was a problem at first, because if I solely depended upon words or language, I wouldn't have learned very much. I've spent the first year desperately trying to learn Thai. And the dialect, they spoke a different dialect. And so that was very confusing for me, to sit there and learn Thai and then a dialect of Thai. And then, but then the actual teaching was much more profound than verbal, because the reflective ways of the Buddhist teachings, isn't it? You're beginning to recognize things, look at things. Life is simple. Monastic life is a simplification of everything. You're putting boundaries on behavior and so forth in order to simplify, not to punish or to control yourself, but to give the options, take less options, have less options for behavior. So your movement is more limited, and which keeps it must, then it's easier to keep centered in the present. When I began to feel gratitude towards Lungpo Cha, then I'd think of the Buddha. In 1974, I went on pilgrimage to India. I went to Bodh Gaya and the different Buddhist holy places and felt this incredible kind of joy and bliss just being in the places that historically were identified with the historical Buddha, and tremendous gratitude toward the Buddha, who I didn't know, the historical Buddha. But then this feeling, the good fortune of a life that was able to tune into Buddhism from a totally different cultural background, social background than a Buddhist. Living in a country that where Buddhism was associated with the most kind of ridiculous objects, a fat man that you used as an ashtray, into real awakening, because this is what how I would say the initial experience with Buddhism. It was the experience of awakening. Something awakened in me that wasn't awake before. So that very awakening and recognizing how that power of awakening, taking a teaching that began 2,500 years before, which to me, an American, is ancient history. You know, 2,500 years ago, it seems, you know, that's, you know, it's more modern than the dinosaur, but it's pretty ancient. And it, and then being in India, you know, a country so far away and so different from the United States. And yet, once I heard, began to listen to the teachings of the Buddha, something in me awakened. So it was the teaching of awakening. And this is the essence of Buddhism. And that's why it is a teaching that is timeless. It isn't about ancient history or old cultures or old civilizations or old religions, but it's about awakening, waking up to the present. So then in life in Thailand was one of tremendous gratitude, because my life, my experience as a Buddhist monk in Thailand was one of, unbelievable generosity. People were so eager. The whole country, you know, the whole country of Thailand was so eager for me to be enlightened. This is how I reflect. They'd do anything to help me to get that way. So of course, you know, monks don't need a lot. They have robes, alms food, shelter for the night, and medicine for illness. But there was always this sense of real joy and eagerness coming towards me to support my monastic determination. And so I've always really been grateful for that. You know, that's something that I really value, because it has made it easier. Just that kind of generosity has made it easy, much more easy for me to practice meditation, to develop. Because I haven't had to think a lot about, you know, we can't handle money, so, you know, then I don't have to think about that. You're celibate. And you still got, a male body. In those days it was young, with all its energies and testosterone. But you simplify everything by being celibate. You don't get into the complications of sexual activities or relationships. So, and then the in terms of the people I was living with, when people come to monasteries, they're usually on their best behavior. You know, the monasteries don't attract the mafia or the criminal elements. At least if they come, they're on their best behavior. They don't proclaim themselves. I've never been mugged in a Buddhist monastery. So just reflecting on this, the generosity of the lay people, the wisdom of the Buddha, that was a teaching that he could actually put into a traditional form that could survive the rise and fall of so many empires and situations, and from 2,547 years ago. And it's still alive, isn't it? Still powerful, vibrant, and practical teaching. So in my life, I have a lot to be grateful for. And yet, the tendency of mine, say my basic conditioning, is one of a critical person that tends to love to see what's wrong with things. So if I get too grateful to the United States, then I begin to sound right wing or like George Bush. if I'm too over the top about gratitude to Lumpa Cha and the Theravada Buddhism, then I sound like a sectarian Buddhist. And on and on like this. I'm aware of this. It's not to just deny the other side, but to bring this feeling of real happiness into my consciousness. Because gratitude is a heartfelt experience. It comes from here. You know, when you don't try to define it and analyze it and figure out whether there is such a thing and whether try to pick it apart on the analytical level, you're noticing how the heart responds when you start recognizing the good things that one has received from life, from one's parents, from one's society, from one's friends, from the teachers, from the tradition. Here in Britain, I've been in Britain many years, and also there's a lot of katanyu toward this country because my life here has been very pleasant as a Buddhist monk. You know, in terms of the country itself, it's the country I really like, and I've had a very good experience here, so I don't have a lot of negative perceptions about it that I can, fix on and complain about. So this developing these qualities of generosity within one's own life. And then the tradition itself, as we practice here, is the Dana Paramita, developing this generosity is very much an important this is how we survive. It's through generosity that the monastics can live here. And so it's always amazed me when I look around me sometimes, see this temple in this center at this time, which was all the result of donations, free will donations. And we have no businesses, or we're not playing the stock market or anything. or nobody won the lottery and paid for it. It's just so it is the result of generosity, and as all our branch monasteries are. And this says very much. This is a good reflection for the nature of human beings. Lungpa Cha saw humanity as basically good, kind and generous. And this was quite, at first it seemed rather naive to me, because if you're one who dwells on what's wrong with humanity, and my Western conditioning very much never thought of human nature as being basically good. Somehow the idea of being human always claimed that you were a bit weak or selfish, or you know, you're a sinner, or you're not perfect. There's something a bit off about you, and the idea, the cynic of who can you trust? You know, everybody's out for themselves. The modern materialistic attitude of get it for yourself first was quite powerfully perceived in my generation. So in Lungpa Cha, attitude of recognizing the basic goodness of humanity, and this he pointed out to me, you know, because I doubted this very much. Like, idea of going back to the United States as a Buddhist monk seemed an impossibility, because I was seeing I was too much limited by the tradition. I saw, well, you have to depend on Buddhists, and to be generous, because nobody else is going to be generous. You can stay in Thailand, and people are generous, so that's the only place to be. And Ajahn Chah would have none of that, because he pointed out, wherever there's kind people, you can go. You can go anywhere, in other words. So seeing this is also reflecting and beginning to appreciate yourself as a human being, rather than seeing yourself as a human being with flaws and weaknesses or faults and inadequacies, neuroses and problems. I recognize your own goodness. You know, we respond well to kindness and love and beauty. When people are kind to us, or generous, or understanding, something in us responds. We feel it from the heart, a sense of appreciation, gratitude for this kindness. We can see it in so many cases, and just the way the international scene is now, the way the concern for the HIV/AIDS problem, and even though it's probably not handled all that well, there is, you know, generally a feeling of wanting to help these people throughout the world, in the wanting to solve the poverty of the third world, of caring about others other than just, you know, I've got mine and I don't care what about the rest. We can also be selfish and then the next moment not be. So in this reflection on metta, also recognize that in this practice we're developing this attitude of receiving. So the selfish moment is received, it's accepted, it's acknowledged. It's not criticized, And then we let it go, we let it be, and it goes. The feeling of gratitude arises, feeling of joy and gratitude at the kindness extended to us and the goodness of others. And then that stimulates an interest in trying to help and trying to do something good for them or help others in some way, help the society. So then that's our active side, you know, we can't just live doing nothing. So if we're going to do something, then that active side is the acting on the through this joy and gratitude of giving back, of repaying the debt or the goodness we've received, the kindness we've received, the generosity, the security that we have. So in this way we begin to understand our humanity. And this we share. This is so clear in the Buddhist teachings that about being human. It's based on the noble truth of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness or suffering. This is a human experience. So in our common humanity, you know, then we begin to recognize that we're all very much the same thing. You know, we're not, the suffering for us and its qualities can be varied and different, but the fact that we all experience suffering, whether you're in Africa or Israel or India or Britain, Thailand or Sri Lanka, wherever, isn't it? Not the suffering is not really any different. We can see that this way of reflecting is very much needed because it brings us together as a human family that then respects that and begins to not want to cause intentional harm. We don't want to cause more division, more misery, more pain, more suffering onto other human beings, no matter who they are. Because of our goodness, when we begin to accept also our selfishness, our badness, but not identify with it anymore, then our good side can become quite active and powerful in influencing the world around us. And in the process also of bringing us that joyous quality of being in which our understanding of Dhamma increases, where wisdom is perfected through wise reflection on the way things are, on the way it is. So I offer this as a reflection for this afternoon. Since we're meeting, I don't know whether Lada's prepared tea or not. No. So, yes. So now let's just sit for a few minutes and just practicing metta. Acceptance of things as they are and then bringing up into your mind the perception of your parents in the way of remembering them and their good qualities. See what happens.